Hello, I'm Ross Cammage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science. And I really mean across the full spectrum of life's experiences, and testimony to that is my next guest, Professor Tilman Neckman. Tilman, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Certainly. My name is Tilman Neckman. I'm the father of two boys, Fletcher, age 12, Reese, age 16 as of yesterday. I am a professor of British and British Imperial History at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York. And I am a lung cancer widower, having lost my wife, Laura, after a 9.5 year battle with lung cancer 6 months ago.
And that's what I really wanted to dig into, because I felt like, you know, we talked about patients and people who look after patients and scientists and all of that jazz, but the caregiver is kind of omnipresent and doesn't usually get the light shone on him or her very much. First of all, where did you meet Laura?
Laura and I met as undergraduates. We were college sweethearts. So I realized when she died, I had probably never made an adult decision without Laura by my side. We met first week of college at Georgetown University, became fast friends that year. As I say, she turned me down for the big annual diplomatic ball in D.C. at the end of that academic year, only to realize subsequently that she should have said yes. She lacked vision, as I like to say.
Yeah, it's good that you didn't hold that against her.
No, I didn't. 30 years later, I still remember it. We were undergraduates in the School of Foreign Service. We then migrated. She was from Southern California, and we migrated out west afterwards. She wanted to go back to the West Coast. I had decided to move away from an international affairs diplomacy career to history, and ended up with an offer first at the Claremont Graduate University and then at USC. And she did her law degree at USC in Southern California. So it worked out that we ended up back on the West Coast. So we actually have the same set of degrees, USC and Georgetown, but she trained as a law student at SC, and I got the PhD there.
Got it. And then when did you get married? What year?
99.
And how old were you at the time?
We were 24. Yeah.
So cute.
24.
Yeah. And when did the boys come along? I could do the math, but it's easier to ask you.
Reese was born in 09. So we were a good sort of free and swinging single couple for 10 years.
Nice.
Out in LA. It was, the grad school career is what it is. You don't have children in law school if you know what's good for you. You don't have children at the PhD program if you know what's good for you. And so Reese was born the year I got tenure here at Skidmore in 2009, and Fletcher was born in 2012.
So you moved back from the West Coast to the East Coast.
Skidmore brought us to the Northeast and to the
Okay.
You don't leave Southern California willingly. It was a tough call, but it's been a good move.
It must have been a good job offer. We know what kind of, English history professor, but what kind of lawyer was Laura?
Laura did corporate contract, international finance, and consumer credit finance. Her first firm in LA did import-export, a lot of Hyundai Motors work. When we came here, she actually had a hard time finding work. The greater Albany area is dominated by a couple of law schools, and ended up initially working for Eliot Spitzer. Without getting political on it.
Should I know who Eliot Spitzer is?
He was the governor of New York, and he was only the governor of New York after he appointed Laura for a couple of weeks before he resigned in disgrace over a prostitution scandal.
So Laura was his last good move?
Laura was his last good move. She worked there at the Consumer Protection Agency under Governor Spitzer and then under Governor Patterson before she ended up at a firm based in New Orleans that had an Albany office that did consumer credit. So during the pandemic, if you followed the Dodd-Frank laws and all of those laws about consumer lending, Laura was an expert on those. And at the time she was diagnosed, was really finding, I think, her professional stride in that world, back and forth to DC, sought out to speak and publish and write on the topic. And that's one of the things that has motivated us to become advocates in this lung cancer space. Well, as we realized, here was a 40-year-old mom with two small kids and a bright professional career, and all of it waylaid by a diagnosis that was sort of unimaginable.
So let's let's talk about, I think that you told me the boys were like 2 and 6 at the time
of
the
diagnosis.
So how did the diagnosis happen and how was it first communicated to you from Laura?
In 2 weeks will be the 10-year anniversary. Laura and our oldest were coming back from skiing. We'd been skiing the day before up at Whiteface here in New York. She was in incredible health. But the evening that she was coming back from skiing with our oldest, Reese, a freak car accident in a snowstorm. Another car was approaching in the wrong lane. And as Laura looked, she was honking. She realized that because of where that car was and where the cars in the proper lane were, there really was no way to get around. It was a particularly snowy year. There were snowbanks on both sides of the road. So she attempted as best as she could to thread the needle between the two cars. But the driver in the incoming lane of traffic saw Laura at the last minute and swerved into them. The accident, I saw the minivan. We had a Honda Odyssey. Later, it was ripped in half. The passenger side second seat where Fletcher's car seat was had been ripped out of the car and thrown about a half mile down the road. So had he been in the car, had someone been in the driver or the front passenger seat, there would have been fatalities. But Laura and Reese were taken to the local hospital here in Saratoga Springs. They were diagnosed with severe concussions, some soft tissue damage, some minor scratches and abrasions. And out of an abundance of caution, we said, sure, do some body scans. And they came back and said Reese was fine. And they came back and told Laura, you've got some sort of a mass in your lung and you might want to have it checked out.
Wow.
And they said no more. They said these sorts of things pop up all the time. We were assured that ancillary findings in the medical field are almost always ancillary. So Laura got in touch with her GP the following day, said, I am having some concussion symptoms. Can you write me some notes to stay home from work? Things of that sort. And the GP called back later and said, sure, but we've got to get you in because I've got the data on this mass they found and it's profoundly worrying. And so Laura pulled it up on the portal and we started looking at the information. At the time, we'd never read a scan report that would come to change. And we started reading the scan report and seeing things like ground glass in the imaging report. We saw the size of it. It was a 4.5 centimeter tumor in her left lower lung. And if you go to Dr. Google, a tumor of that size in your left lung is not statistically anything but cancer.
Yeah.
And so we began at that point to realize we were probably going to be confronted with something rather major. We owned at the time an old house, a 200-year-old tavern, and it just sold the barn from the 1770s. And so we, the neighbor who sold the barn was remodeling it, and it swept all of the bat poop, the bat guano, out of the barn. And the other option was a histoplasmosis fungus. Yeah. And I remember us very diligently hoping for histoplasmosis, which is not a good outcome either. But those were the two things before we began the process of seeking the diagnosis.
And how were you? Were you kind of like, matter of fact, it's interesting that now as a historian, you're throwing around things like soft tissue injury. You have learned a new vocabulary.
Yes. Oh, I've completely learned it. Laura and I were Georgetown School of Foreign Service students. Neither of us took science or math in college. They used to refer to the SFS, the School of Foreign Service, as safe from science. It turns out you are never safe from science. It will find you. We both learned a new vocabulary, and I think Laura would want me to say we were proud of that. We came to realize, and this is something she pushed in her 9.5 years as an advocate, you can do it. You can learn what you need to learn to be a partner. Would I trust myself in surgery or in the lab? No, but I can understand, and you need to understand, particularly if you are sick enough to be on the cutting edge. And we really quickly learned that that's where we were going to be. The local pulmonologist that we met with looked at this and he said, you're a never smoker. You're from California. California banned inside smoking before any other state. You've grown up in a landscape where there's no reason for this to be. I've never seen this before. And I remember Laura saying, well, what would you do? And he said, I would find someone who's seen this before. And so he was the one who said, get yourself to Dana-Farber over in Boston. Fortunately, here in Saratoga, we're 3 hours from Montreal, Boston, or New York. So we had options.
Okay.
And fortunately, I will put in a plug here, the Skidmore College Health Insurance has been remarkable in saying whatever needs to happen, needs to happen. One of the things Laura did a great deal was experiment and play with dosings, with combinations of therapies. And the college's insurance allowed for some of that, which means not only was Laura, as an advocate, putting her life and body on the line, the community here was backing that with funding that allowed us to get to Dana-Farber right away.
Okay. So, again, what I want to figure out is the impact on the family and the impact on you, the impact on the boys. So at what point does this become a diagnosis that is kind of like, well, it could be, but it could also be these other things. And so, you know, when did the other shoe very loudly drop?
2 weeks. PET scan, biopsy. We did have a bronchoscopy, and it was, there was no question. It was an ALK-driven adenocarcinoma, left lower lung with lymph node involvement, stage 3A lung cancer. So it was a good 2 weeks from that point. In that period, we don't have family near us here, so we had called both of our moms up to from California and from Georgia to be present. You're right. I talk about it now with the historian's perspective, putting myself back into that sort of psychological moment. I remember mornings waking up going, I'm in some sort of a nightmare, and I'm going to wake up sweaty and gross and go, whoop, that was a doozy. And then you go and look, and Laura has decided to start a shower and is just sitting on the shower floor sobbing. And then Fletcher is in the bedroom screaming, wanting food. And so one of the first, Laura and I were always type A people, do it yourself, take care of it. I remember the great deal of humility it took to call and go, someone's got to come. That we're not going to hold this together in this initial moment without someone here to back us up.
And that was the two moms.
The two moms came, yeah. And we're here. My mother was here, I think, if I remember it correctly, my mother was here at the time of diagnosis. Her mom had gone back out west. And then all the families came. And so because we knew at that point we were going to be dealing with a disease that forced me and Laura with two small kids, for her to take a leave of absence from work, at best a leave of absence. We were going to be going to Boston for at least some portion of the care. And of course, once you get to Boston and realize that Laura is going to be doing, at that point, Dana-Farber was doing, before surgery, a radiation chemotherapy combo. Chemotherapy, you can move site to site. These are the little things you learn when you're not in the oncology world. Chemo can be prescribed and delivered anywhere. Radiation is specific to the machines and to the radiation oncologist. And so the decision to do the daily radiation treatments through Boston really meant Laura needed to be in Boston. So for a brief period, we took an apartment in Boston. She lived there. I traveled back and forth or arranged someone to be with her. And we were confronted, as many young cancer families are, with the question of how do you live the life you want to live as a husband and wife, caring for each other in sickness and in health, and also be parents to young kids? And the answer was juggle. And that's what it took for about 6 months before Laura finished the chemo radiation, had a lower lobectomy with some lymph nodes removed, and was finally able to come home to New York for a stretch.
How did you explain to the boys, even though, I mean, the two-year-old probably didn't even know what was going on, but I mean, how do you explain what was going on, at least to the six-year-old?
Yeah, Fletcher has no memory in life that doesn't include cancer. Reese vaguely does. I give this advice often to people who have cancer and kids. We lied up front, and I don't think it was right. If I look back and go, when were there mistakes we made? This was one of them. We told Reese Laura had a cootie, and we had to get the cootie. And it seemed like good language. And we were dealing with the lung, and you know, we really quickly looked at the data. Lung cancer is a doozy, right? It's and Laura's first, she looked at me one evening, and she's like, this has to be beatable. If it's not beatable, then why aren't we hearing about it? So she Googled Well, it's not beatable, right? It's an intensely deadly disease.
Well, I mean, when she was diagnosed, there was a small chance of cure. Presumably you latched onto that.
And we did, but even then we knew that the probability of a cure at 3A was slim.
Yeah.
And so then we went to, well, it has to be incredibly rare or else there would be outrage. And then you start looking and actually it's a very common cancer. Laura, her MO was to tap into that outrage. There ought to have been outrage here to mobilize something. But we also knew that when we said lung cancer to people, we were getting the face. And you can't do that in a podcast, but there is a face for brain cancer, lung cancer that you get. And we didn't necessarily want the six-year-old to get the face. So we went with
the face of kind of like, that really sucks, or the face of you brought this on yourself.
You're about to die.
Oh, okay.
That others look at you with. So we said cootie, and Laura had gone for a week of radiation. I was actually home working on a Lego set. It was the Star Wars X-Wing fighter Lego set.
Excellent choice.
I bought them. It's a great choice. We still have it. And we were sitting there working on it. I'm an academic. I'm what I call an Oprah man. I'll talk about my feelings. My sons are not those kinds of men. So my six-year-old son's putting together his pieces and he says to me, Dad, I know Mom doesn't have cooties. And I was like, well, why? And he says, well, Maverick tells me cooties aren't real. Yes, my son has a friend named Maverick. Maverick tells me cooties aren't real, so what's wrong? And I stopped building and looked at him. He looked at me and no joke said, keep building and tell me what she has. Because something about the hand motor coordination in the six-year-old let him have the conversation he wanted to have. And that's when I said with Laura in Boston, it's a disease called cancer. It's in her lung. And I'd already begun to put together some of that language with Laura. You know, it's her cells have changed and are aggressive. And thus begins the conversation that you have with your kids about the biology of cancer that you know at that point they're going to grow up with.
Having had this conversation with many people about how they've told their kids, one of the things is, the first words out of a kid's mouth is usually, are you going to die? Or is mommy going to die? Did they go for the black and white question?
No, I don't think Reese ever did. And Fletcher, of course, grew up not knowing. Even down to the very end, Laura was fortunate enough to have consulted with you a couple of times. Laura was a yo-yo, right? She'd get to the very edge of life and death and bounce back. Even as she went into hospice, these kids went, it's mom, she'll be home in a week. So they actually never ask that. I don't know that anything quite, the only time we got to that question was when Laura finally, about 8 months before she was died, saw her cancer move from the solid tumor state in the brain. She eventually ended up with brain metastases to the leptomeningeal state where it was in the fluid around her brain. And that disease, the word leptomeningeal in the metastatic lung cancer patient, it's the specter, right? Everyone, you don't want to hear that. And they knew that word. They knew that Laura had had friends who had that word slapped onto them, and they knew those friends went quickly. So I don't know that they asked us until then.
Yeah. And then I'm trying to think. So you go through the surgery. As you said, there's this small, single, you know, 10-20% chance of cure. Is there a period of calm water?
We had about
cooties is gone, and
cooties
then we're just
gone. And we had 15 months. It was really, really awesome. You'd go in for the scans at Dana-Farber. They come back clean. They're one of the things that I would say to folks going through it is you will look back and you will realize some of what you did then is not right because you just don't know. And practice at Dana-Farber at the time was not to scan the brain, particularly not because Laura had no brain involvement, she never had recurrence in her torso after the surgery, never had anything reappear that was identified as cancerous. So we never saw anything in the body. We never had any reason to worry about the brain. And Laura was allergic to gadolinium, which is the contrast dye they use for brain MRIs. So in order to do an MRI in the brain, she had a rigmarole of a 13-hour pre-treatment process for the allergy. So we hadn't done it. And she ended up having some headaches. And
before we get to that, Tilma, in those 15 months,
yep.
Does life return to the same normal or a different normal?
No, we lived differently right away. And Laura set the tone for that. We were going to live big. That was some people. And if he listens to the podcast, he'll know who he is. I have a fellow lung cancer widower who refers to it as living life compressed. There is a leukemia patient slash survivor, Suleika Jaoud, who's written a beautiful memoir, Between Two Kingdoms. Her father, colleague of mine at Skidmore, so she's a fellow Saratoga Springs person. So she refers to it as Between Two Kingdoms. Cancerville does something to you. So in that period, Laura immediately began saying, I've wanted to go to Alaska. We're going to Alaska. I've wanted to skydive. So she began the skydiving planning.
That's the last thing I would do. If like, okay, no, you just cheated death. Okay. Let's go skydiving.
Yes, and she did not actually until post-brain surgery. So it was later in her journey, but she did do it. And I'll never forget the look on her oncologist's face at Mass General at the time when she said, I've had brain surgery now. Is there a reason why I should not go skydiving? And the oncologist said, other than the fact you're jumping out of a perfectly good plane. And Laura said, yes. And she said, I'm doing so much to keep you alive. Why would you do this? But she did do that. The cruise to Alaska. I had a research trip to Australia that I needed to make. And Laura was like, why don't we all go? Why am I missing out on some of the global travel that your work provides? Why are the kids missing out? So we began living in a way that was pack up and go to see and to do and to really focus on the, you know, it's that corny Tim McGraw song. You know, I went skydiving, Rocky Mountain climbing. We changed as a result.
And then was there stuff that she always wanted to do with you and the boys? Was there anything she wanted to do on her own?
Oh, she went skydiving on her own. You know, Laura and I talked a great deal about that moment and about what it meant, because she began thinking, you could tell she was thinking differently. She started things like journaling even before she had a terminal diagnosis, because she said it just hit her. There were going to be, whether she died of cancer or died at 99, there were going to be things that she didn't think to tell her children. And she wanted to leave them as much of that as possible. And one of the conversations I remember having early on about it was the difficulty she had. How do you live today for today and live with a sense of hope and also then plan for not being here? There was a real intellectual disconnect and tension. And she, better, I think, than I, managed to juggle that. You introduced the conversation with this position of a caregiver. There's certain things caregivers have to, like, I had to start thinking about on the ground. If Laura isn't here, what would we do? She could focus more on the hope, the optimism, the research, the science, but she did it all the while and frequently off on her own, journaling, letter writing. My oldest son turned 16 yesterday. There was a card from mom that he still hasn't opened, but there was a card from mom. So she began that process, which was her journey that she was making.
How was it for you? I mean, I guess that, you know, we have the kind of insight in health we've made reference to.
Yep.
But it's all kind of like, yeah, but I didn't expect that to happen now.
Oh, or ever. Yeah. It's this kind of crazy promise only a 24-year-old who doesn't know any better will make. And we know statistically lung cancer, cancer diagnoses, severe medical situations test marriages and destroy them. And it does drive wedges. There are shifts in a relationship when one becomes ill and the other doesn't. But Laura and I were always, even to the very end, determined and proud that we were going to live this through to that bitter end. I just finished a C.S. Lewis book in which he says, you know, if you've engaged in the Christian marriage ritual, you've predicted the future. You've said, till death do us part. And you've stood there at this happy, happy day and basically said, but one of us is going to be dead and the other is going to suffer. as a result. You've already predicted that pain is the price of this. And I've known so many people, Laura's lung cancer friends, who have died, and there's a great deal of loss. But with each of the ones, I think of one in particular who was a long-lived lung cancer survivor based out of Boston when Laura was diagnosed, and she was the hope. I forget how many years she'd had when Laura was diagnosed, but Laura went, oh my gosh, if she can do 10 years or at 15 years, think what I'll be able to do from today.
Yeah.
And as she was getting sicker and sicker, I remember she said to me her bucket list was to read Moby Dick, which is my favorite novel and a novel I use for research. And I was like, well, you can't read Moby Dick by itself. There's a syllabus. And we read the syllabus and we read Moby Dick. And at her memorial service, it was her oncologist, actually. She shared an oncologist with Laura who quoted a Moby Dick line that I know meant something to her because we talked about it the day we read it. And if you can walk that walk with someone, it's really profound. It's awful. It's terrible. It's full of blood and, in most cases, death. But to watch someone live out those bucket list moments is amazing.
Go on, what was the Moby Dick line?
I endeavor all things, I accomplish what I can.
I love it.
Not the one I would have used. I prefer, I'm a little more melancholic. I like it was a drizzly November of my soul.
I read Moby Dick, but I actually can't remember any lines. But then, you know, I'm a different
you
kind of
actor. Syllabus. I'll send you the other books.
There you go, I like that. One of the things I wanted to do is, was there... And these are personal questions, Tillman, so take them as they are. But was there ever any resentment on you because suddenly you had become, from potentially an equal focus in the whole universe of the family, to supporting actor?
Yeah, I mean, I often referred to myself as the chief operating officer of Laura Greco Lung Cancer, Inc., and some of it you could have predicted. Laura, there were certain things Laura did not like doing. She didn't like phone calls. She was a big idea sort of person. She had support staff at the law firm. So when Laura wanted to found a 501c3, even though she was the attorney and I wasn't, I was processing the papers. And when I'd say, well, this is really your world, not mine, I would get, well, I'm busy staying alive. And she was right. And I was right. And there's a world in which you can, and this is just a simple rule of marriage. There's a rule in which you can fight over who's right and both be right and you don't win. Neither of you are going to win in that situation. But this is part of what comes in with disease. We had the question, how do we fight? How do you fight if you have just lived through the terror of a cancer diagnosis and all of the shaking that it does to your world? And Laura did in that process have, while she was being diagnosed, she had a bleed from the biopsy site. Cancer tumor, as I've come to understand, is usually got lots of blood flow to it. It chose to bleed. It filled her lung. And that night in the hospital, because she was coughing up blood, they weren't sure what the imaging was showing. And they told us maybe this was time for us to say goodbye. She might not make it through the night. And we're less than 3 or 4 weeks into this. So there was no way to talk about it as a historian. And we hadn't said bye to the kids. She was videoing goodbye messages to the children on the phone. And that was one of those moments where life compressed. She and I lived 9 years together after that night, having said what you say to your loved one when you know you don't have any more time. And so we were able, I think, because of that, in some ways, to say to each other, how do we have a fight? Particularly after she was terminally ill. There's going to come a time when you're not here and I'm going to desperately want you to be here to leave the toilet paper roll on the wrong way or the cabinet door open in the kitchen. Laura was infamous for leaving cabinet doors open. She wouldn't let you eat pistachios in the car. Well, so I now, 6 months a widower, can eat pistachios in their shells in my car till my heart's content. And what would I give to have Laura sitting there going, stop it, you're going to leave shells in the... So how do you have that fight with someone in that moment? Because that duality is always there. And it went both ways. There were times when I would say, we can't go on that trip right now because you're planning too much. I'm tired. And she would say, we don't have time for you to be tired. You can rest when I'm gone. There were flip times when, you know, when I would start, or she would start something, and there was a craft project she started once. And I said, Laura, you know, this, what are we doing here? This is too, and she lit into me that, you know, you're going to have to raise the children. And the guilt goes both ways. There's a reason that the medical literature tells you caregivers have higher blood pressure and gain weight and higher death rates than anyone else their age. My GP gave me all of these things about 5 years in as my weight went up and said, well, we've got to get your weight under control and your blood pressure under control, because caregivers die frequently before their patients and their loved ones. And he's like, we can't let that happen. But it's an intensely physical process.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because there are classically lots of support for the patient. And lots is obviously, you know, there could always be more. You know, but things like psychological counseling and supportive care and all that kind of stuff. And the caregiver is this kind of plus one who sometimes gets invited and sometimes doesn't. Yeah. And I do feel like being the partner of someone with a serious disease is a medical diagnosis in and of itself. It should qualify you for some degree of support and not just being cobbled together from the, you know, a primary care physician who's good at their job and sees what's going on in your life.
Yeah, I like that. I've never actually had someone tell me it was a medical diagnosis in itself, but it certainly feels that way. And I will say, I think it depends on your person. Laura and I talked a lot about her fight. The fight was always for time. The fight was because we had kids. There was a child, Fletcher in particular, who might have no memory of mom whatsoever if this didn't work, at least for some durable time. And so we knew what we were attempting, and we knew why, and we knew that Laura wanted to maximize the advocacy work and the research work that she could mobilize with her professional skills and strength of personality. That set a tone for me. We didn't always have the conversation about whether I could sustain it. You know, I didn't have cancer, so if she could do it, why couldn't I? We did talk about, and we joke frequently, I wouldn't have done a lot of the medical stuff she did. I don't think I would have made as many choices, taken as many risks. I recall she ended up with 9 brain surgeries or interventions into the brain before she died. The 9th one, she was flat tired.
Yeah. It
was for an Ommaya reservoir to be inserted into the brain so that they could inject radioactive nanoparticles into the fluid around her brain. And I don't know if I could have done it. I was so tired of watching her have brain surgeries. Could I have had? But I did say, if you're doing sickness and in health, Tillman, if you're the one who's here as caregiver, you have to figure a way, find the energy, find the resources to be one step behind your person. I can imagine it's equally hard if you have someone who says, I'm terrified by this diagnosis and I don't want to pursue care, which is an option. It would be equally hard to sit and watch them not do anything. Laura and I used to joke we were in the same car accident, and in the same car, different seats. And I wasn't driving.
I think your expression was the same shitty car accident.
Yeah, the same shitty car accident. And I wasn't driving. But my hand wasn't good, was still better than hers because I am here. And so the support I was able to supply was the once more onto the breach for another brain surgery, if that's what you're going to do. I have several friends now. I'm still engaged with folks that we met through the advocacy work. And caregivers will say to me, where do I go when my patient goes back to surgery, when my person goes back? I was like, I don't know that there's an answer. First of all, you don't know surgeon to surgeon whether they're coming to the... That image that happens in movies is garbage. No surgeon comes out in clean scrubs after a 7-hour surgery and, you know, gives you a hug. That doesn't happen. And at many hospitals, the place isn't that comfortable or nice. And in some hospitals, it doesn't exist at all. So you may well be sitting in some corner of a hallway, you know, eating a bad egg salad sandwich. You need a toolkit. You need a go pack with your phone charger and your snacks and your cash for the vending machine. And that's kind of what it takes to be able to be there, knowing that when your person wakes up after a lobectomy or a brain surgery, it matters to them that you're there. And that is a medicine of itself. I used to say all the time, and I would still say to caregivers, if you were a medicine, the pharmaceuticals would charge $10,000 to $20,000 a month for you, because I think we matter.
Yeah. So you told me a story during the time when the cancer had relapsed, and so now we know it's incurable. The first time you're in kind of like the emergency room with emergency brain procedures being done, and the story with the nun. Can you share that one?
We knew the cancer was in the brain, and we knew that she had had a lesion radiated in her lower left cerebellum, so the back of the neck. I'm horrified at that I wander around the human brain, but this is what I've got.
Yeah.
And the tumor, or the residual tumor, was swelling. Question, was it radiation necrosis? Was it swelling and disease and sort of side effect of having put radiation into the brain in that area? Or was there recurrent or resistant cancer that was growing? And little did I know, little did Laura know, but apparently those are hard to discern on imaging. That's a field of study for anyone listening who's in med school and wants to. We need better imaging so we can see and know, because it matters. And we were guessing, do you have a surgery to remove it? Do you not have a surgery? Do you use Avastin, which is a IV drug that is generally good at absorbing the radiation necrosis kind of material and the swelling? Do we use steroids? But Laura continued to slip into decline. The children refer to this as the barf age, because if she stood up, she threw up. And we had to buy a supply of those blue hospital bags. What had happened was her cerebellum had swollen to the point where it, the phrase is tonsillated, it sort of began to peek out of the skull at the base of the neck there. I can't get a picture of what that looks like in my head, but
it's called herniation, tonsillar herniation. So it's just like if your brain is toothpaste, it's starting to come out of the tube, and that's a bad idea.
And as they said in Boston, it's wicked bad. And in addition, it had begun to squeeze upward and close the ventricles to Laura's brain, so she was not, the fluid wasn't circulating in her head properly, the brain pressure was building up, and all of the pain was related to that. And we woke up in the middle of the night, she was screaming, I called 911. Before the folks arrived, she slipped into unconsciousness, and we got her to Albany Med, which is the bigger hospital here in the region.
Just in context, so the two boys are in the house. You call 911, and what you just like look after yourselves. I'm going to the emergency room.
So it does indeed take a village. I called a political scientist friend who lived not far away. Laura left me and our boys with a village of people from here to Timbuktu that look after us and love us. And I'll say their names. The Taylors, Flag and Natalie, are friends in the Thomas Aquinas sense of friendship for us, like brothers and sisters to us. I called, and Flag, in the middle of the night, came over, staggered into the family room, and was like, whatever you need, I'm here for the kids. And the two techs came, picked up Laura. I followed her in the car, thinking I might need to come home. And so, because Albany's 45 minutes away, because I parked in the parking lot and the ambulance took her into the emergency entrance, we were separated. And they did not let me back immediately. When I finally got back, they had sedated Laura with opioids for the pain and were waiting for imaging. And I was like, well, heck, this is another thing that you learn. You need to have a packet. It needs to have your most recent scans. It needs to have medical ID and information in it. Because if I had been able to give that to the techs that night, they would have had all of that. They did not know by the time they let me back she had cancer. All they knew is that she was in pain, and they had sedated her to deal with the pain, and they would circle around later. In that period, the pressure continued to build up in her brain, and she wasn't waking up. She wasn't coming around like she was supposed to. So they were going to take her off to do a scan. And I had noticed that when people left to get the scan, they came back an hour or two later. And it just did not seem right to me for her to be away for an hour or two. My gut said, we don't have that kind of time. And so when they came to wheel her, there was a sign on the wall that said, if you don't act respectfully to all the medical personnel here, we will ask you to leave. I grabbed the gurney and was like, no, either I go or you can't go. Well, then she doesn't go. And I just started shouting her diagnosis until a neuro resident who happened to be in the ER that evening flagged me down and said, come here. And I drug her with me. And we started, and he then said, we've got to go back. And we did a scan. Sure enough, her brain was, I guess, stopped up for lack of a more technical word for it. And he gave me this form and said, I need you to consent to an invasive brain procedure. We're going to drill a hole in your wife's head. We're going to let the fluid pressure out. We're going to put an exterior drain in, and it's going to be a tube. And the brain fluid, as it builds up in pressure, will just equalize with the ambient atmospheric pressure based on where we put this bag. And I signed it. I had power of attorney, right? I braced for this. We had all the legal stuff in tow. What we had not done was dealt for what that was going to do to my heart. And I went out because they actually left me behind the curtain with her, an old fashioned, you could see it at Colonial Williamsburg, wooden handle crank. And he cranked it. And as soon as he shaved her head, as soon as he got through, the fluid just started like Vesuvius out. It was way much more information than people want to know. And Laura would be horrified of sharing. And she said, as soon as it started to flow out, she went, whoa. Like, she actually said a word. She was clearly not there in her proper way, but for the first time, words had come out of her mouth. And I was like, whoa, she's going to be okay. And so he's like, while we get the tubes in, why don't you go step out? And I stepped in the hallway and sat down and just started to bawl. I was there by myself. And the enormity of having authorized brain surgery, basically. I mean, I'm told that's not technically brain surgery, but it was an invasive brain procedure on another human and another human whom you love and another human with whom you have children, and realizing I could have to go home and tell them I let them do this to mom and she didn't survive it. And a nun walked by. She was on Catholic duty that night, and she just pulled me up, gave me a hug, and I profound moment, goosebumps for me, that she was there, because that's the situation and the kind of corner a caregiver gets in.
Yeah. And what did she say to you?
Oh my God. Well, she did a lot of things. First of all, I had dust all over me. So she actually said, this hospital is filthy. But she told me a couple of things. What comes to me now, I still remember her saying to me, she's like, you've made the right choice. And she didn't even know what it was. She didn't know what I was in there for. But she, she's like, you've made the right. And I guess you need that sometimes, you know. And I thought a lot about,
like, unconditional love from a third party.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, I thought a lot about it. Laura and I both did. On a day-to-day basis, and I say this to you as a doctor, and with all due respect as a doctor, because what you do is amazing, and why anyone chooses oncology, I don't know. And how you do it, I don't know. But a doctor can't come into a room and say, well, I don't know much, right? I don't know. But one of the things, I say this to my own students, when we die, there will be more that we don't know than that we ever learned. And that is true of doctors, as well as historians, as well as bricklayers, as well as lawyers. And with the human body, that leaves us in a really frightening place, that these experts know less than they, or know what they know about the body is less than what we don't know. And I think about a dear friend who lost his wife, very, very similar genetic cancer to what Laura had, was, I believe, a patient of yours. And his wife didn't respond to the drugs that Laura did respond to. And I remember talking to them. They were younger than us and behind us in the process. And sitting down with scans of their data and scans of our data going, why isn't it working for you? Now, I'm sure you don't appreciate me and Laura checking up on you on that way, but that was what we as patients and caregivers were asking. And what it boils down to is there's something else going on in this disease that none of us see yet. And we will see it later, but we can't now.
Yeah.
And that's why certain drugs work for certain people and don't for others. And every day we're moving forward. But the balance between saying you're at the frontier of medicine and it's an exciting place, there's all sorts of stuff going on and advances are happening. And because you're at the forefront and on that frontier of medicine, there's going to be guesses. And I felt viscerally I had just had to play doctor in some way, not the screwing the machine into her head, but making that call. And was it right? Yes. Was I lucky? Sure. Because I didn't know this guy from Adam. I just met him in the hallway because I was shouting her medical data. And so to have someone affirm, hug, just go, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay.
I mean, you have to make decisions with the facts that you have at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they're imperfect. And it's an imperfect, chaotic situation. And at least medically, the way I deal with things, if they go wrong, is I say, if I went back in the time machine,
yeah,
would I do something different? And if the answer is no, then it doesn't matter if it was wrong. I'd still made the right decision with the available facts.
And we came to accept. Today, they are asking questions about whether after a lobectomy and after pre-surgical chemo radiation, you go on a drug like a TKI, one of these genetic inhibitor drugs that Laura used to very good effect right away in a sort of preventative way. That was off the table when Laura was there. I recall her asking people, this is part of the reason we made the leap from Dana-Farber to Mass General, was she wanted to ask everyone who was working on drugs that will be familiar to people in the lung cancer world, like alectinib and lorlatinib, could I go ahead and start them and would I get a benefit out of them? Now, at that point, the answer was put it in your back pocket. Save it for if your cancer returns. When it returned, we went on those drugs. But at that point, we knew those drugs weren't curative. They were merely extending life. Today, people are asking questions about using them earlier. There are trials using them earlier. But that's today. And Laura's not here to do that work today. She was there doing it then. And we knew that. That was that. And that's hard because you're second guessing it. My favorite historian, if I can history nerd out, is a guy from Australia, Greg Denning. And he always says that the historian's job is twofold. First, it is to look at the past from the present with 20/20 hindsight and to make critical judgments. And the second is to give the past back its present. And to understand that they didn't have that hindsight that you have. And so you're doing these two competing things simultaneously. And he said they are intellectually incompatible and absolutely essential. And that's where you are in medicine, is you're making choices today, knowing that in the future, what you have to know is perhaps better, certainly different, and might change what you did.
Yeah, so one of the things I tell my students are, you know, it sucks to have cancer, but it's better to have it today than yesterday, and tomorrow would be even better.
Yep. And that's the hope, that you kick the can, you move it down the road. That certainly was, and Laura became this person. At 10 years, or at 9 years, 8 years, she was becoming that person. New diagnosis, it hit someone and they would call us, because Laura was very open about our phone number being on things, her email, her Twitter handle, all of that, so that people would reach out to her. And she said, I am perfectly content to be the hope. And I recall one young woman, probably only 19 or 20, who was diagnosed, asking Laura, and Laura also spoke in the language of miracles and hope. How can you believe in hope and miracles given what's happened to you? And Laura said, this was Laura's famous line, given what's happened to me, all I got left is hope and miracles. And so those two became somewhat easier for her. She was a half empty kind of gal. I was the optimist in our relationship. You know, the glass is half full. But when she became terminally diagnosed, she said, hope and a miracle are all that's going to keep me alive. She used to say this to her own medical team. Is this your standard of care? Yes, that's not what I want. Because what does standard of care get a stage four patient? Dead. And so she, this was Laura at her more macabre. You must think outside of the box or I'll end up in one, is what she said.
Oh, that's a good line.
And so she was perfectly willing to try what had never been tried, because what's never been tried is what's going to be the answer.
Yeah. The other thing I remember you telling me is, you know, so this is, and this battle is going on, and you used the expression that it was like being in a war.
Mm-hmm.
And the trauma that you as a soldier might have experienced, you know, with your colleagues at risk, affects you, and how you internalize that again, you know, this constant low level stress fluctuating with high levels of stress.
Yeah.
It's this isn't mine, this is another cancer patient, again, the dear friend with whom I read Moby Dick. It's ongoing traumatic stress disorder. Right. There is, and she and I talked a great deal. There are, I know I step on all sorts of toes when we use, because a lot of people don't like the metaphor of war for cancer or for illness. Suleika Jaoud, who's again the author of Between Two Kingdoms, prefers to think of it as sort of having two passports to the world of healthy and the world of unhealthy. And we all carry two passports. That's fine. I don't disagree. But there are moments when it is, when the language of triage is more applicable, when attack, assault, the enemy make a lot of sense. And partly in part because Laura embraced the language of war, I embraced it. She was a warrior. She wanted to be seen as a warrior. She wanted to think of herself as you know, in battle. So I always use that, but I've never disagreed, because I mean, when I look at the trauma that has happened, our oldest has written a essay, or is working on an essay that he's been asked to craft. And the question is, as you've asked me, husband, caregiver, what's it like? The question they've asked him is, child, growing up with this, a disease, you know, lung cancer, in particular, these genetically driven cancers, hitting people far younger than what we imagine lung cancer to be, and the lung cancer patient to be, what does it do to you? And Reese said to me when he wrote his draft that he's still editing, he's like, you know, I didn't realize there's not really much of my life that isn't touched by this. Like, you took me to Australia because mom was just out of brain surgery. We did this because mom had just done this. Like, he's like, there's almost a one-to-one every time cancer kicks us, I got a trip out of it, or something happened. The pandemic came. New York was this sort of hotbed. Laura was like, I don't want to die. Shut up. So we mapped out how, part we tested. We isolated after testing negative. We mapped out parts of the country that were completely clear. I did not want to do it. I hoped that Laura's team would tell her it was unsafe and foolish. And if a certain oncologist who said yes to this is listening, she was right. It was awesome. We got in the car and we drove across the country. We spent about a month and a half on the road. We saw 26 of the contiguous U.S. states. We went to all the national parks out west that were open, but outdoors, and no one was there. We had the dog in the car. It was awesome. And Reese observed, all of those were contingent on mom saying, the enemy is here. We've got to, you know, let's have a feast, basically.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the things that you told me is you felt there was a need, because you're the person who you normally confide in is fighting their battle and they may be deteriorating, you know, mentally, emotionally, and everything, that you needed a third person. You needed someone to roll your eyes at, I think was your expression.
Yeah. You don't roll your eyes at a cancer patient when they ask you for food or water. And this is true of the entire tenure journey, but I am most proximate to Laura's last 6 to 8 months, which the decline was precipitous. She had a tumor on her left motor strip that had been radiated twice. Surgically, we attempted to remove it twice. It was as you know, because this was an issue Laura consulted with you on, it was triple mutated. The ALK mutation had to pick up a MET mutation, had picked up an EGFR mutation. It's just unheard of and unprecedented that someone would merge three inhibitor drugs in that context. Laura had merged two to good effect to fight the MET and the ALK, but that tumor was out of control. Radiating it a third time was going to destroy the motor strip and leave her without the use of her hand, her speech, the ability to walk and swallow. Cutting anymore was going to do the same, and leaving the tumor was going to do the same. And we both knew it was checkmate at that point, but we also both knew that was going to mean a slow decline as those abilities and capacities disappeared. Her hand disappeared. She couldn't use it. Her leg began to weaken, so she needed a walker or a wheelchair. Her speech started to slur, and she had to use a speech program, an iPad with a speech and a touch and say program. So you're on call. There's no other word for what I was. I was on call. You know, bathroom, the computer would say. Well, you have to get up because now someone needs to go to the bathroom, and you can't let her sit and not be addressed in that way. The balance of how do you be you while you're also on call and function in any way as a father or a professional is really difficult. You will roll your eyes. I still, at night, sometimes when I close my bedroom door and I'm alone, that's the hardest as a widower, I still sometimes kick myself over an eye roll, right? You'll go, oh, I should not have done that, because she would see them. And so that means I'm adding to her journey to carry the burden of knowing this is a burden to him. But I also know that she was carrying at that moment, you know, that she was probably, if she could have punched more buttons, would have gone, damn it, why do I have to hit bathroom just to get up and go to the bathroom? So we both are suffering, and we're suffering in diametrically oppositional ways. The ultimate need, the ultimate giving. And as a result, again, I'm not saying I'm not perfect. I rolled my eyes at Laura a lot, and I feel that. But I found friends, and you have to. You have to find a shoulder you can cry on, someone you can yell at, because this deserves to be yelled at. I had a priest friend early on who said to me, you're going to learn that screaming is a form of prayer.
Wow.
And that was really awesome, right? To be able to say, if you believe, if you're practicing in a religious context and you believe in some sort of a personal relationship with divinity, a personal relationship, sometimes you go, this makes no sense. Screw mysterious ways. I want some clarity here. And to be able to say that is what needs to be said in that moment. So finding the friends, finding the circle of people who will let you yell when they know it's not at them, but it's at cancer, and letting the patient, and coming back with the energy to take her to the bathroom, or let her sometimes yell at me because she needs it too. If you think about a bullseye, the patient is the center, the caregiver's that next ring. You're going to get kicked. You're going to get hit with a dart at some point, but you have to find the way to sustain your own strength doing it.
Let me move to the next chapter, as it were. So at some point, Laura passes on, and I just want to know how that absolute moment, okay, this has now happened, and how you address that with the kids, and then what's happened since then, and how long ago was that? When did Laura die?
6 months ago. She died on July 13th, so it was a little over 6 months ago. Yeah, I think it's the moment that I had dreaded it. Laura and I talked pretty openly about what might happen. We'd had that moment early on. We had all the paperwork in preparation. As some of the drugs had inhibited her cognitive ability, she'd handed over bill paying and things like that to me. We were okay, but I'd asked her, what do you want me to tell the kids? Let's assume I'm in the hospital with you. Let's assume you'd pass. What should I tell the kids? And that was a question Laura, in terms of preparing, Laura could never answer. And it was a moment I dreaded, because I feel like it's there's just an utter helplessness as a parent in that moment. And Lord knows I felt enough moments of utter helplessness in this 9.5 years. You know, even questions about professional choices. Why did I not take science? Gosh, I could have been the one. If I had only taken science, I'm frittering my life away with the British Empire. And you know in your logical mind that's wrong, but that's where you are. And so this dread was profound. My boys are amazing. Everyone says that about their kids. They have, I think without knowing, I hope without knowing, done more to sustain me and Laura than they could have imagined. Maybe other parents would agree. This may be a veer off into a podcast about parenting. That just sheer, unrelenting, like, I will do anything for these two, you know, Papa Bear, Tiger kind of sensibility. I did come home. Laura died at midnight, just before midnight on the 13th. So I came home on the 14th, Bastille Day. I like to think that a revolution began in heaven when Laura got there. As one of her patient friends said to me, God help God. I woke up. This is sort of funny now. The boys were up. My parents were here. And the boys were eating pretzels. And I walked out because I slept in, and I looked and I was like, oh my gosh, they're motherless. And the first breakfast they're having is prep. Like, this is exactly what happens when you're raised by only a father. And I took them aside and I told them, and they handled it remarkably well. I think they both knew at the end. They both had said she would bounce back. Then I took them in to see her in hospice. She was in the hospital when she passed. And that ended up being harder than saying she was gone, was taking them in. Because I think when they went in and saw her in those last moments, she hadn't been able to eat. It had paralyzed her ability to swallow. And as a result, she couldn't take the pills. Laura was on 75 pills a day at the end of her life. And she'd been on that for about a year and a half, mostly potassium. And we can talk about why if you want, but I don't think it's completely necessary. But she couldn't swallow. And there was no way to IV in that much potassium. And so that was when she knew it was done. And I think when they came in and saw her in hospice, I told both of them independently, Mom's gone into hospice. She'll bounce back. And I assured them, you know, Mom doesn't fail. If Mom sets out to do something, Mom's going to do it. And in this instance, she set out for it to be the end. And we went in and they both broke down then. I think that was my hardest two moments, is watching Fletcher spoke to her out loud. So I know what he said to her. And watching a 12-year-old figure out and navigate what is the right and the wrong thing to say to Mom. The 16-year-old, now 16, was 15, did not, he got in bed and sort of whispered. So I don't know what he said. But I had told them both when I told him she was in hospice and that we were going to go in. And I think this is the right call. You can't do it right. You can't do it wrong. Nothing you can do here will feel right, and nothing you can do here will feel wrong. And then I told them something that remains true. They'd broken the chronological narrative. Usually a parent loses their parents first. I don't know. I still have my mom. I don't know what it's like to lose a mom. And in a weird sort of backward circle of life, when I do lose my mom, my kids are going to be there for me in a way that they might not have been otherwise. And so I freely sort of owned, I don't know what to tell you. There really isn't anything. And so the three of us have pushed through from there, very open about the changes, what it means to live in a house without Mom. We've been able to do things really freely. No trip insurance. You want to go this weekend to fish? We go this weekend to fish, because we don't have to worry about a seizure, and we don't have to worry about whether the medicines are there, and we don't have to. And on the one hand, that feels good. On the other hand, you realize, and we all three have felt it, oh, I should feel guilt because I just said this is good. And it was Fletcher who articulated it best one night at dinner when he was trying to sort of grapple with that. He's like, what's good is mom took the cancer away from us, right? It was not mom who caused any of that chaos in our family. It was this effing disease, right? And it's gone. And I think that was probably the smartest articulation I could have put to it.
Yeah. Tilma, let's pause just for a second. I do have to ask you the question, though. He's called Fletcher after Fletcher Christian.
Yes, he is. You caught me. I am a total... So you may appreciate this better than others. He was supposed to be Fox after Charles James Fox, the 18th century English radical politician and my favorite politician of the 18th century, because I am that kind of person that says I have a favorite 18th century British politician. But he was born and he was the most passive. Reese, and I'll boast for a second, Reese may have been the worst baby of all time. Nothing calmed him down. He was colicky and a hot mess. And we didn't know any better because we'd never had a kid. We then had Fletcher. You could put Fletcher down on the floor in the den and leave him, and he would sleep for hours unattended. The dogs would step up. He was amazing as a baby. And so when I saw him, he didn't cry when he was born. He didn't. So I'm like, this is not a Fox. He's not going to be able to pull off Fox. And we had a backup list of names, and Laura just was like, I like Fletcher. Fletcher, and I was like, you know what's going to happen is it's going to be associated with my second book project, which is about the Mutiny on the Bounty and Fletcher Christian.
So first of all, thank you for being so honest and so raw with us about your experiences with Laura. It's hard to answer this question, I know, but what are you thinking the future is going to bring over the next few months or years?
Laura made me promise as she was dying in the hospice setting, a couple of things. The first was that I wouldn't screw up the kids.
No pressure.
No pressure at all. And the way I put it is this, I belong to them. First and foremost, I belong to them. Make sure they get through this. That is the work. It has meant pausing my own professional work. I am a historian. The people I work with don't go places, so they will be there. I can circle back around and write a book if I need to later. These kids are here. So dad, that's how I identify first and foremost, is dad, and that's the work. Laura also told me, don't stop until this disease is gone. And I don't know, Laura held out a little bit more, you know, like we're close. I don't know that we're as close as she thought we were. It's hard to feel that we're as close as she thought we were with the if it's a battle, with the defeat that we experienced in July. But I do want to continue working in that capacity. She and I did a lot of fundraising work. I want to continue doing that. We worked with a couple of different lung cancer research foundations. I want to keep doing that. She worked with the Department of Defense, and I'm continuing to work with them. It's the DOD that has commissioned the essay from Reese, actually, and we're working on that. So we do, the three of us have said, we want to continue to be present as advocates and as activists, and to make sure people remember Laura's fight. I know in one of my children's cases, they have a friend whose parent just got cancer, probably imminently treatable, but it's still going to suck. And the kid has stepped forward and said, I'm going to talk to him. I'm going to talk to him about what I know. And I think that's a goal for them, and it's been a continued goal for me. I became more versed in science. I think that will fade with time. I don't know that I'll continue to go to ASCO. I've been once. That was enough. So my science may grow outdated, but I hope that I can still be there for other patients, other advocates, to honor the work that Laura did, because she said right up front, I'm not going to get this and not have it count.
I think that is an amazing note to end on. Tilma, I just want to say thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with host me, D. Ross Camage. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on @DRCamage on Blue Sky for additional commentary.